This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by good friend and noted, noted senior lecturer, award-winning senior lecturer at Northwestern University in the School of Law and Communication.
Right, right. Jason, and you're, if, you know what, if you are noting it, Rick,
yes,
then it's worth noting.
Then it's noted.
That's okay. It's noted.
Well, I want to make sure I got the rhetoric right, because that's kind of up your alley here.
It's something I've been doing for a long time. Happy to do it here.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, particularly since, obviously, last week we had President Trump's State of the Union address. And I want to play one cut from that initially. And then I want to tell you my thoughts of the speech, but then I want to hear you know, having analyzed it, what your thoughts were. But you had the president lashing out about the investigations that are being launched by Democrats now that they control the House, not only of Russia, but also his personal finances, his tax returns. Here's how the president kind of characterized this.
Together, we can break decades of political stalemate. We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions, forge new solutions, and unlock the extraordinary promise of America's future. The decision is ours to make. We must choose between greatness or gridlock, results or resistance, vision or vengeance, incredible progress or pointless destruction. Tonight, I ask you to choose greatness.
So, I know he's big on alliteration. But one thing that struck me, and this is more in an overall sense, is, you know, you structure a speech where you have kind of specific subject areas to go to. And in fact, I think I was watching it on ABC, and they actually had, like, the checklist of which. But I'm glad they had that on the screen, because he would end one subject and go right into the next one, and there was no stopping point. And I found that to be disorienting and basically disjointed.
Okay, so the State of the Union address generally can be a laundry list. There's going to be all kinds of different proposals that are made. And so that makes them hard to keep coherent. And so over time, different presidents have had different techniques for trying to do that. Obama would come with a theme every year that he would open the speech with and close it with, maybe with a story of some kind. But they're always unwieldy. The difference here was Trump's delivery, because in a lot of those places, there are natural breakpoints that he was just blowing through. So if you were to look at speeches over time, the transitions might not be that clear in prior State of the Union addresses. But there were a couple of times where, having watched the speech and then watching it again, I had to play it back in sections because he had just blown through what should have been just a pause.
A natural break.
A natural break, and then moving on to the next section, and he just didn't do that.
Well, and you know, obviously he stuck to script, and stuck to the teleprompter, which, you know, these days, you know, people give him credit for not deviating.
Well done, man.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a very good speech because he stuck to the script.
Yeah, this is teleprompter Trump versus Twitter Trump. He's very conventional when it comes to the State of the Union address. It's one of the few things in any aspect of the presidency. Yeah, but from a communication standpoint, it's one of the few things that he is conventional about. One of the reasons that I think he wanted to end the shutdown was he wanted to get into the House in order to give the State of the Union address. He had no interest in giving that speech anywhere else, despite all of his threats to the contrary. That's where he wanted to be because of the spectacle of it. I did feel
And the fact that the focus is on him.
Oh, completely. Completely. And he plays that up very theatrical moves to the left and right to different parts of the gallery and gesturing up. I did think he handled the theatrics of it more effectively this year than he had last year.
I thought the props were good.
The people.
Yes.
Yes.
The people props were good.
They were good, but then also, of course, the other aspect of that is those props, those people were not the only people, the only symbols communicating in that room. And so he wasn't controlling all of that. Certainly the women that were there who were dressed in white and then sort of stole a moment from him were also doing that. And that's appropriate in the sense that this is a speech that is not only one that has a constitutional component.
Right.
Article 2 of the Constitution says the president will give information on the State of the Union to the Congress from time to time. Doesn't have to be a speech. It started being a speech again with Woodrow Wilson. But even when Wilson did it, he did it for the symbolic value of signaling bipartisanship, that he wanted to come over, inter-branch comedy between the branches. So there's always been a ceremonial component to this speech. It's a ritual. And in a ritual, many people communicate. And so the props that you mentioned, Rick, the people that are up there in the gallery, since Ronald Reagan put Lenny Skutnik up there in 1982, are one aspect of that. But then, of course, now we have all the guests
right,
of people attending. So that we had all these members of the Illinois congressional delegation, and Elizabeth Warren brought a guest, and all these furloughed workers.
I mean,
as well.
That's a ritual now.
It's, now that's and that's designed to communicate things too, right? So you have sort of this continuum of communication that's going there. People trying to influence the audience at home, and that makes it for a really rich experience from a communications aspect and from a persuasion aspect.
I want to ask you, I mean, obviously on Twitter and in some of the post-game commentary, and I watched it, and I spent special attention not only looking and listening to the president, but also at Nancy Pelosi behind him.
Yes.
And kind of seeing how she was cueing
yes.
the Democratic
yes.
members. But someone said about how, well, the Democrats basically sat on their hands. Now, I didn't necessarily find that to be the case. I frankly saw them joining in the applause more often than I expected. I mean, I would have expected them to sit on their hands. But I don't think they really did.
No, I don't think they did any more than has been typical in the past few years. And also, in some of those shots that I noted, there were some members of the Democratic side that would stand while
on
others
their own.
Would not. Chuck Schumer stood a yeah. few times for some things while other people did not. So there are differences, and even that has a communications aspect. You remember a few years ago that Republicans and Democrats were talking about whether they were going to sit together.
Yes, right.
To symbolize, to communicate the idea of bipartisanship and working together. I did not find the applause part of it to be particularly noteworthy one way or the other.
No, but you did hear that same kind of criticism.
A little bit.
Democrats.
I thought there was more of a focus on Pelosi and kind of her theatrical movements through the speech and these comically large pieces of paper.
Well, she does kind of contrast to Mike Pence, you know.
Right.
It's not hard to look outsized when you've got Mike Pence.
Well, I mean, he is a dynamo. I mean, he's not.
I was going to say, what?
Right.
You're the specialist on rhetoric. What message sending are you doing there?
Stillness.
Stillness.
It's a rhetoric of calm.
Calm. That's it. Exactly. Jason DeSanto is with us. He's senior lecturer at Northwestern University. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Northwestern University's Jason DeSanto. We're talking about the State of the Union address and the messaging going on in that. And we mentioned about Nancy Pelosi. And one of the things that Democrats, as part of their investigations, one thing is clear. They also want to look at the president's tax returns. And press conference after the State of the Union address, Pelosi recounted a conversation that she had had with a hotel worker about the public's desire to see the president's taxes.
It was a Martin Luther King Day in San Francisco, going through the kitchen to go to the event for the breakfast, and one of the people working in the kitchen said to me, I have to tell you this. When the president says that the Mueller investigation is going on too long, you just say back to him, not as long as your tax audit, Mr. President. I thought those were words of wisdom.
That's Nancy Pelosi. I think that's a pretty good line.
It's a very good line. The president has never been particularly consistent about a number of things, and that's one of them. And, of course, during the speech, he, having recounted great economic success, as he sees it, claiming credit for most of that, Then went on to say, essentially, if you want more of that, we need to stop with these investigations. And not only that, we need to stop with the investigations so that we're united at home so that we can be strong abroad. And that is a kind of a theme. And I'll say two things about that, Rick. First of all, it hurts his long-term credibility because it's not consistent, although I don't think he's ever been
worried about that.
But the second part of it is it's also something that we generally hear. It's a rhetoric of authoritarianism. Protect the leader and you will be protected. And that is a consistent theme. You know, thinking about that State of the Union address, there were takeaways for the immediate term, 2019, the short term, 2020, and then the long term. And the immediate term was, I think Trump was admitting he had lost the shutdown. He talked not at all about the shutdown, but still maintained that walls will work, still maintained his position on the border. And so what I think that signifies is he's going to lose the shutdown but claim victory. And if you look at some of the negotiations that are going on now, there's this semantic debate about what it is that's actually going to be in the final legislation.
What's a barrier?
Is a barrier a wall?
A levee wall.
Yeah, right. A whole host of names. And so there'll be enough there that he'll claim that it was the right thing. That's 2019. 2020, essentially, I take it that it's a reset of his brand while carrying the baggage that he's always carried. And the baggage is, he just has very little credibility with large swaths of the American electorate. The number of people who would be willing to say, forget it, wake me up in an hour when Stacey Abrams starts talking, is a pretty high number. But his brand was reset. And that is what that State of the Union address, particularly the year before an election, can do. 1995, Bill Clinton, coming off being thumped in the 94 midterms, came back and reset on a very moderate course, talking about opportunity, talking about responsibility, talking about welfare reform, crime reform, those things.
School uniforms.
School uniforms. And then into 96. And this was that kind of a speech, approximately the same length, about an hour and 20 minutes, just like Clinton did in 95. But there were the same themes about anti-immigration, anti-free trade, and to some extent anti-government, fused with the economy and these trappings of patriotism with World War II. Colloquially, we call that populism. And that was his coalition. That's the medium term. Long term, for the history books, this is the rhetoric of authoritarianism consistently. And that goes all the way back. There is something to fear, and I will protect you from the fear. And that is a departure from what most presidents do in these ceremonial addresses, State of the Union addresses, inaugural addresses, where the talk is about citizenship and common bonds. That's what Obama talked about. That's what Reagan talked about. Shining city on a hill was all of us participating in the hill. That's not the rhetoric that Trump uses. The rhetoric that Trump uses is there is something that is scary. MS-13 is out there. In the inaugural address, it was about American carnage. There was more about MS-13 in this speech. And as he said in the convention speech in 2016, I alone can fix it. And that is a very leader-centric kind of rhetoric. And it's very consistent with being not transparent about tax returns, making sure that nobody is able to get the things that I have so that I can continue to protect you. Don't question me so that you will be kept safe. And that's a consistent theme. It's very much consistent with what leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary are doing around the world. And on the one hand, we call that populism. And on the other hand, it's a hard-edged populism, which is really authoritarianism in terms of rhetoric.
And as I played in that initial cut, too, that casting these investigations as, you know, vengeance, that same kind of, you know, trying to immediately, now obviously if you're being the one being investigated, you're going to try to assail the credibility of an investigation.
Sure.
But to kind of cast it as a move of vengeance.
Well, and that was the extra level. So when you think about crisis rhetoric and presidents that are being investigated, there are two examples in the past that we can point to relatively recently in the last generation or so. One is Nixon and one is Clinton. So Nixon in 1974 said 1 year of Watergate is enough. Bill Clinton in 98 and 99 during Lewinsky just cited a bunch of economic statistics. And basically the implied argument was you never had it so good. Trump did both. He basically said, we've got all these great economic indicators here. And oh, by the way, if you want to maintain that, you got to stop the investigation. Basically, 2 years of Bob Mueller is enough. was essentially the argument, and that had the threatening component to it.
Well, and you also had him say to the words the effect of, you know, if I wasn't standing here, we'd be in a depression, we'd be in a war.
We'd be in a war with North Korea, and that's the other thing, right? Fear and protection. Those are the two pieces of the rhetoric. We would be in this terrible war, but for my existence. And that was the point at which the reaction was laughter.
Exactly. Room, right? Yes. I want to switch gears in the closing seconds that we have to talk about the mayoral race, obviously, now just a couple of weeks away. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you're seeing from the candidates as far as their messaging, from the TV ads to what they're saying in the debates.
Multi-candidate debate, multi-candidate race, compressed time, it makes the messaging, to me, fascinating because there are two goals of it. It's both simple and complex. The simple part of it is just name recognition. For large swaths of the Chicago electorate that doesn't know a lot of these people, that's where money helps, being able to get up on TV and having a good ground game, being able to go door-to-door and talk to people. The complex part is distinguishing from each other. And what we have is a struggle of these candidates to do that, and it's coming into sharper focus because of the ads that we're seeing, but also because the debates are becoming more frequent. They've been in forums for the last 6 weeks, about 30, yes. 35 of them, but now they're really in a format where there are fewer of them that are in each of them, and they're allowed to go after each other. And so this is where candidates are really beginning to find the contrast. And what we see is contrast about all sorts of things. And contrast has to be believable. You have to be the most trusted candidate on that particular issue. Polling tells you only so much. Polling will tell you what's most important to the electorate. But what campaigns often miss is you've got to say why you, out of 8 candidates, 10 candidates, 14, are the most credible on that issue. So you think about the 4 issues in this race that are the largest. Crime, corruption, schools, and the budget. Right? Those are really the 4. They're all saying essentially the same thing, some slight differences on each of those. The difference is that the one that's been in the news every day is corruption.
Right.
And that's the one that's driving coverage. That's the one that's driving cameras. So that's why it's a bunch of people saying, Ed Burke, never heard of him. Who is that guy? You know, never heard of Danny Solis. And that has put a couple of these candidates on the defensive. It's made it hard for them to affirmatively put their messages out, to define themselves. It's hurt Mendoza. It's driven her numbers down. It's driven down Preckwinkle. Preckwinkle is essentially running as the incumbent in this race. She's the one that's being targeted the most by the others. And so you have this situation where all these candidates are trying to define themselves but are being defined by the corruption issue and kind of surrounding that. And that means in the last 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to have candidates shooting off in all directions, particularly because the goal here is to finish in the top 2 and get to the runoff. So you're going to have candidates who are trying to identify themselves as progressives, not just shooting at the candidates who are perceived as the establishment, but as the other person in the progressive lane. So Lori Lightfoot, for example, has gone after Tony Preckwinkle. You're not a progressive. If you're trying to define yourself based on gender, same thing. Lightfoot goes after Preckwinkle. Mendoza goes after Preckwinkle. And then you have candidates like Bill Daley, who are establishment candidates, but are trying to message to different groups to cobble together enough of a percentage to get the second. So what does he do in the past week? He rolls out an endorsement from Bobby Rush for the African-American community. He rolls out Howard Dean and Al Gore for establishment, but also progressives. And then even when he doesn't show up for the debate, he makes sure that everybody knows that he didn't go to the debate because he got a union endorsement. So for blue-collar workers, right? So even that was a way to signal and symbolize how broad the support was.
And it all comes down to whatever minuscule percentage is going to be enough to make that runoff. And I mean, that could be 15%. That's how varied this field really is.
All you have to do is get to number 2. And so because of that, I expect that Preckwinkle will continue to get a lot of attacks, particularly during the debates that are left. And she has not been a particularly adept debater to this point. And I expect that Mendoza will continue to go after Daley because it helps her with establishment. It helps her in terms of the gender dynamics of that debate. It helps her with her generational claims. And I would also expect Chico to go after Daley a little bit more on the commuter tax because the recent polling has shown Chico at number 3 and Daley at number 2. So he needs to go after Daley, and I think we'll probably hear that.
Stay tuned for more. Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be here.